Pat on the Door is a transitional album. Stylistically, it's very eclectic, much the way The Top was, and it's similarly burdened by a couple of ethnocentric pastiche songs like The Blood and Kyoto Song. But in contrast with The Top, these dalliances are less self-serious. They're not like sheltering sky, drug dream dirges. They're more sort of stereotypically British. They're more caricatured. They're more coy and clever. Having been in Susie and the Banshees and being one half of the glove with the Banshees bassist Steve Severin, Smith's kind of coming off an extended gap year here in late 1984. He's been part of an established band with an arguably bigger celebrity fronting it in Susie Sue, and so he's been able to learn a lot of lessons about what you can do as a pop idol, how you can tune and tweak things, play with the press, play with your image. And coming out of this period, Smith is sort of leveling up in terms of maturity. He's in his mid-20s, he's seen the world, and he's beginning to be feted as a potential pop star, even before Head on the Door and the hit singles coming off it. In 1984, he's getting covered in like those pin-up teeny bop magazines in England, these tatty folios where you'll see like George Michael and Adam Ant and Boy George, you know, set up against a solid color background. In some of these magazines, you will see pictures of Robert Smith around this time. Chris Perry and Polydor are absolutely trying to market Robert Smith to the mainstream, and he's beginning to acquiesce to some of this activity. He's letting himself be put out there in a way that he hadn't at all during the original sort of doomer trio run of The Cure. The substance of The Cure's fame in the post-punk era, in the gothic fog of faith and the lysergic psychosis of pornography, that whole period is somehow so distant. Just 3 years later, not even three, it's absolutely crazy that The Cure were able to return with Head on the Door in such a polished image and get that over, especially with those older fans. You know, previously they've been draped in black leather and wearing lipstick under their eyes. Like, it's a remarkable thing that they were able to come back in tailored linen suits. It's really down to Smith's winning personality and how the press enjoy his company, whether it's because he's being disarmingly honest or because he's being press-baitingly dishonest. That's its own source of amusement for the press and wins them plenty of coverage too. For Smith himself, as a maturing musician and a budding celebrity as well, he's looking in the mirror in the end of 84 and trying to figure out, like, what is it that I do? What do I bring to the world of pop stupidity that no one else does? What's unique about me, and therefore could be unique about The Cure if I start to take it more seriously and bring this thing back? And looking back on those 2 years of lunacy with the pop hits, the dream singles, Banshees, The Glove, all that, what Smith realizes is that his unique quality is whimsy. This is what differentiates The Cure from the calculated cold distance of a New Order, the Clever by Half Smiths, or the now cartoonish goth bands coming up like Sisters of Mercy, even The Mission, where it's just total panto. The thing that separates The Cure is that Smith stays in touch with whimsy and with kind of like youthful wonderment. And if you look at that in terms of the band that explained this to him, it was being Susie and the Banshees and seeing how their lack of whimsy, of any sense of fun really in their music and performances, how dramatic and consistently kind of harrowing the Banshees were, that held them back from ever crossing over to the charts. Sure, they had Dear Prudence, but that was Robert's idea. For the most part, Susie and the Banshees remained an albums band. And it's this tick-tock ping-pong. Not, you know, forget the whole New Order Cure thing. Think about what happens with Susie and the Banshees and The Cure. Because right after the Head on the Door, when The Cure start having hits, what happens with Susie and the Banshees? You know, in the early days, the Banshees' bloody-mindedness is sort of to their credit. But Smith has now seen both sides of the coin. He's taken it as far as he can in both directions. He's gotten as melodramatic and self-serious as one can be on Pornography, which, again, that's a record that in many ways can be interpreted as sort of a younger sibling to the Banshees' Juju. You know, in the same way that Kaleidoscope is really a primer for Head on the Door, Juju is the template that pushed Smith to go as dark as he did on Pornography. Oh. But he's also been as unserious and stupid as you can be, with stuff like Mr. Pink Eyes, all those drunken B-sides like Speak My Language and Throw Your Foot, even the Love Cats itself. Like, 83 and 84, this is sort of Robert Smith's piss artist period. You know, he's sleeping an hour a day, you know, recording the Banshees' Hyena and Nocturne, The Cure's The Top, The Glove's Blue Sunshine. Like, when it comes out of the other side of this, Smith is completely ragged. He has totally burned himself out. You still have a ton of thematic uncertainty on the Head on the Door. In terms of where The Cure is going to go, half the record is retreads and hangovers from The Top and Hyena. Six Different Ways is Swimming Horses. In Between Days is Like an Animal. Look at the B-sides from Head on the Door, particularly Stop Dead and A Man Inside My Mouth. I woke up at 7, I'm a bunny, watch my brain ting. I was wrapped up in a blanket, I was great at the soul. The pension was an engine, I'm a hobby, was a writing clock. I think I'm at the racing, but the night before. And then, like, the album tracks, Screw, even The Baby Screams, these are stylistically much closer to The Top than anything on Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. A lot of this stuff is sung from this weird, louche disco character Smith makes up around the time of The Top, what I'd call, like, the Man Solid Gone persona, where he sings in this, like, over-the-top, warbly, Bowie baritone. It's Smith, like, trying to access or comment on the male ego or, like, trad masculinity in some way, and it's really relevant to this period because in the promotional run-up to Head on the Door, Smith gives some surprisingly kind of laddish interviews, you know, talking about how much he drinks and parties. He spent last night throwing up prawns in the sink. There's a famous interview on French TV where the whole band are playing footy on a pitch in their gray suits. You know, he's necking lager, slagging off Simple Minds and Spandau Ballet. If you look at the marketing of Robert Smith in this period, taken in total, it really does give the appearance of a somewhat concerted effort to reassure audiences of Smith's masculinity. Despite the hair and the makeup and the Mad Bob shit, you know, don't worry, kids, he's still a traditional British guy. There's some really awkward, strange stuff. Like, there's that infamous photo shoot with Stuart Adamson out of Big Country where Robert's wearing the Three Lions kit and, like, jumping for headers. It's just like, go and get your dad, mate. Simon coming back, you know, that gives a lad aspect to The Cure, internally at least, because the two of them were really like the toxic twins of The Cure in that classic rock sense back in the trio days. They're always egging each other on, and, you know, Simon kind of had that sneering punk rock attitude, fuck this, you know, fuck Robert Palmer, fuck rock and roll. The two of them played off each other. Simon loved having Robert's back, and, you know, he was his heavy in so many ways. It's a brand new lineup, so they're very tentative, they're feeling each other out, but Smith's also ecstatic because he's gotten the lineup. He got Boris in. He's got this tool now in the toolkit, which he wasn't even aware of really until Andy Anderson was in the band for the top. Now he's got like a phenomenal mid-tempo rock drummer who's not least also fucking great looking. So he's got his best mate back in the lineup with Simon. Looks were never a problem there. Like, Simon made The Cure image-wise. And Pearl's essentially family for Robert at this point. He's got an elegant look of his own. You know, it's got obviously quite a bit of femininity to it, but that's offset by him being a classic sort of Jimmy Page gunslinger. His guitar playing is absolutely effortless, and particularly in the American market where there is still a ton of homophobia, you know, it's not just like there was this huge untapped audience of sensitive goth kids that came screaming for The Cure. The Cure also had guitar solos and guitar work and were taken sort of seriously, or at least taken notice of by, you know, those kind of like macho guitar magazine types. Not saying like heavy metal kids were, you know, crossing sides and coming over The Cure, but my point is they weren't a synth pop band. You've now got a band. You've got individuals that own their role in that classic rock and roll lineup. But there's a lurking anxiety for Simon here, and it never really goes away. Because from 1985 on, it's like, am I really back? Because you have to remember, The Cure didn't break up in 1982. Simon was more or less kicked out of the band. Apart from a summer holiday, Robert kept working with Lowell the whole time, all the way through the Let's Go to Bed period and the top. And Simon's been passing that time in the shit band of Cure roadies called Fool's Dance. So to be able to go back to The Cure, you know, that brand and Robert's fame having grown so much in the interim, being the bassist in The Cure from 1979 to 1982 was Simon's identity. And it became too much of his identity. He became something of a swashbuckling bassist joke at the end. A little bit too much Sid Vicious in there, and Robert called him on it, and that's what blew him apart. So now Simon's got the ring back, and he doesn't want to fuck it up. And my point is that for this reason, he will let Robert walk all over him. The power dynamics in The Cure are fundamentally broken from here on out. Lowell's substance abuse was a pretty serious problem as far back as The Walk, but that classic negative spiral, it doesn't really start to get sour until Head on the Door, because in 82 to 84, Robert is equally as fucked up as Lowell is at any given time. I mean, look at the Love Cats video. They're both completely fucking legless. So there's no real finger pointing that could be done at that time. But when you get to Head on the Door, the stakes change, because it's not just Robert and Lowell anymore. Robert's cut back on the boozing and the drugs enough to get himself in much better shape. He's lost a bunch of weight. These changes show you that Robert is taking the image more seriously, the business of The Cure more seriously. This band could amount to something. I can write hits that don't have to sell me out. The market's there for this. Like, kids are buying New Order records, they're buying Echo and the Bunnymen records. Polydor can see that I can compete in these stakes. I can hone my celebrity, entertain the press, and do this all on my own terms. And it's only in hindsight that you can map out this kind of tragedy and the sadness of it. Robert's choices indicate that he's not treating Lowell as a creative equal. It's an ugly thing to say, but, you know, decades later, I think Robert even recognized it. You know, like, their relationship, like so many others in Robert's life, were increasingly on Robert's terms, which is a really dehumanizing way to live. Lowell made significant contributions to The Cure, especially on Faith and on Pornography. He's hurting as Robert's mate at not being able to find a role in The Cure that was as clearly defined as it was when he was the drummer. And that means he can't find, like, not just a sense of pride, but a sense of being on equal footing. That's all fundamentally gone now. Everyone else in the band can weather that because they have their own identity. Simon's the dive bombing, punky bassist, Pearl's the gunslinging guitar player. They all have identities. And, you know, without that foundation, Robert can't be the frontman of a rock band. So they have a purpose. Lowell falls outside these stakes, starting with the Head on the Door. But the rest of the band also know he's the one constant in this band apart from Robert. So until and unless Robert's calling out Lowell's behavior, I guess it's okay. The only person that doesn't have this baggage is Boris Williams. He comes in clean. You know, for his entire run in The Cure, I really think he was kind of reading the tea leaves most of the time. He forms a special bond with Robert, establishes himself as an inextricable piece of The Cure magic at this time. But I'm really not sure that Boris needed the band as much as the band needed him. But like, certainly at the outset, Boris is ecstatic because he's been stuck in a synth pop band, you know, making really good money playing for the Thompson Twins, but it's not very fun. Now he's in like a proper, somewhat off the rails rock band, one of the only ones left. And it's fitting that Boris's excitement is kind of the first thing you hear on this record. At this point in 1985, nobody is doing like John Bonham, Misty Mountain Hop fills like this. Dave Allen has the snare batter mixed so high, it sounds like Boris is just doing a snare roll, even though he's running down all the toms, because every time he hits them, the batter vibrates and the room reflections come crashing in. It's such a fucking sweet production. It's really well done, but it's kind of incongruous up against anything else on the record. The other thing with In Between Days is there's an extended 12-inch remix, which I've always been hung up on. I love it. I don't understand why it wasn't on the deluxe edition of Mixed Up, that 3-CD edition, because the 12-inch 1985 12-inch version of Close to Me was. It does this thing in the beginning, you know, they're just paging through tape and rearranging measures. It's an extended remix in the 80s is kind of a joke, but they do this thing that's sort of rented from that earlier Glove song, Like an Animal, where they build up an intro that delays the acoustic guitar coming in until like midway through a measure, and it creates such an incredible energetic explosion. I've always adored that move. I always wish there was like a perfect mix of In Between Days that incorporated that. In terms of weird little moments like that in The Cure's catalog that lunatic fans like me remember, that's one that people are not going to remember because this remix has been essentially thrown in the waste bin. And In Between Days has a sister song here, one of the most cherished pop songs The Cure has ever recorded, and it's not on the album, The Exploding Boy. What happens here is the band and Chris Perry take the decision that you can't put both these on the album because they sound too similar. This seems like such a short-sighted decision and mistake now in the streaming world that we live in, the CD world even that we lived in, where pop singles have been lost. But it is true, and it's important, the way people thought back in the 80s. A 7-inch single was a really meaningful and important component, not just of marketing an album, but financially, in terms of avenues to make an album profitable. You also have to put out those singles to get additional buys. You know, you're not selling a kid one record, you're selling him a record and two singles. That's the main reason The Exploding Boy is left off. But I mean, it's also shades of the fact that Robert wants to give his fans strong B-sides versus, you know, like Stop Dead and Man Inside My Mouth. Those are obvious B-side fodder. They're songs that are complete and they're worked up, but like they just don't work. Stylistically, they're way too far off the reservation. And then B-sides are also a great way of dealing with stuff that's too experimental, like New Day, Around the Time of the Top, and Happy the Man. And that's what happens to a few hours after this. And absolute peach of a song, another like historic, like 100% of Cure fans adore a few hours after this. It's so unique. It almost has like this aristocratic parlor vibe, like you're at a garden party or a costume ball. It's so evocative of, you know, stereotypical pomp and drama. And it's so singular in their catalog. There's no drums. It's an example of going for it, of Robert Smith having an idea and just going all out on it, embracing the fact that you're using synthesizers, you know, not trying to tart it up or make it seem real, not trying to mask it or demonstrate your largesse by hiring a real orchestra. It very intentionally leans into the technology of the time for its kitsch value, almost like a tribute to what's in front of you and what you can do with it. And the lyrics are straight out of Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. There is nothing even close to as predictive of where Robert Smith is going to go as he perfects his craft after Head on the Door. Squeeze me till I'm dry. I never thought you'd ever stop to ever ask me even without the whole bias of streaming culture and playlist culture, the Head on the Door could have been a much more significant and stronger record if the Exploding Boy and A Few Hours After This were on it. And it wouldn't have upset the running order in any way. The standard runtime, industry runtime for a 33 and a third long player is right around 22 minutes aside. Both sides of Head on the Door as released are just over 18 minutes. So even back in 85, you could have put, you know, A Few Hours After This, like After Six Different Ways, and then kick off the B-side with The Exploding Boy. And just in adding those two tracks, you know, it's ahistoric to think this way. Each side, though, would still come in right around 22 minutes, and you've added another strong pop song in Exploding Boy that really would have buttressed that second side nicely. Because, like, look, A Night Like This is a classic. It's sort of like a mid-tempo Roxy Music rock song. I wanted to be perfect. But really, the B-side of Head on the Door is a strange piece, especially if you think about it from the perspective of a casual fan who might have only heard the singles. Even though it becomes a single, and like it's an eternal fan favorite, they still play it every show, every encore. The album version of Close to Me is not particularly appealing. It's disquietingly, uncomfortably claustrophobic. It's just a creepy, paranoiac mood piece that really goes nowhere. It has no dynamics. What really sticks out when you compare what Robert and Lowell and Phil Thornalley and Andy Anderson were all doing in that 82 to 84 period is that the bass lines are gone. Close to Me is a bass line. It's almost nothing else. And then you have the bass lines carrying In Between Days and Push and Night Like This. That driving foundational bass line, that's what The Cure lost in the window when Simon wasn't in the band. That whole period, you don't have those hypnotic, repetitive bass lines that had previously defined The Cure. Obviously, A Forest being the classic example of a song that just is a four-note bass line and works. Now you've got those metronomic, hypnotic bass lines back in the mix, and that's what makes the Head on the Door sound so much more like The Cure than anything they had done in the window since Pornography. If you listen to Head on the Door front to back, again, it really does not have any thematic continuity apart from the production, and it is that leaden 80s production, the gated drums. It's a terrible plastic mid-80s mix. Just typical 80s indie production, like a band that's on a major label but is recording with absolutely no budget. You're not in the Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me stakes yet. You're not spending 3 months in the south of France, ensconced in Miraval in a vineyard, prepping 40 songs for a double album. You know, Robert had a batch of about 12, 13 songs, and at that time, his band wasn't a profit center. So the expectation was you bang out an album every year and you tour it, and you come in on time and under budget. Until Head on the Door and the success of In Between Days and Close to Me, The Cure don't break free of that churn. That's been the way it's gone ever since the late 70s for them. And Head on the Door is the last record in that cycle. So the album's banged out in under a month, I think, at Angel Studios. You know, I bagged on the production kind of using Kyoto Song as an example earlier. I loved it when I was a kid. It's beautiful. All that formless gothic imagery, these moonlit vistas that Kyoto Song conjures up. It's wonderfully sung. It's a beautiful performance from Smith. When I look back at Kyoto Song now and I situate it inside The Cure's entire discography, I think it's an attempt to recapture the sound of Pornography. It's like he was trying to take something harrowing and hollow and terrifying as, say, Siamese Twins and make it better or make it more spectral and poetic. It looks good. So the Head on the Door comes out in the summer of 1985, preceded by In Between Days as the first single, and it does really well. Chris Perry wants Polydor backing this band with a real budget for FM radio and MTV. I've been telling you for 5 years that this guy is a good bet. He's not just a one-hit wonder with the Love Cats. And so Perry has to map out a campaign where there are multiple singles. You've got In Between Days, A Night Like This is pretty much a shoo-in, but Push is too aggressive and the intro's too long. Even though Push sounds like something that would really work on hard rock radio in America, it's still way too alternative rock. It's one of those willful Robert Smith songs. That song, while it's brief and it's just kind of a verse, chorus, verse deal, it's something that, you know, he put together on his own terms. Nobody was pushing Robert in a way that worked in any case, obviously, to turn Push into a more standard pop song construct, because it could have been the, you know, second or third single from this record. Instead, Push becomes, you know, one of the all-time fan choices, the Cure fans, Cure song kind of a thing. You know, the version on In Orange is one of the greatest moments in the Cure's entire catalog. Honestly, this is sort of like Robert Smith's Bruce Springsteen song. He never writes anything this obvious in terms of straight up classic rock guitar progressions. I think of Push exactly the same way I think of the song M from 17 Seconds. It's one that the fans get because they get the album and they do the homework of listening to the record front to back. And the casuals who are listening to radio never really know about it. So the issue they're facing here is, what is the next single? Because Close to Me, as it exists on the album, it's almost like a demo. There's just nothing to it. Again, it is so minimal, so pointedly, intentionally minimal, that its claustrophobia is really self-defeating. So for the first time in the band's catalog, they really tear a song down to nothing and build it back up again in the studio. And so Robert goes along with restructuring Close to Me in a more pop single kind of format. You have more standard verse, chorus, verse structures. You build the track up to that usual pop crescendo at the end with all the horns and trumpets and saxophones. And it works beautifully. It completely changes Close to Me. It's so mental that you can have this original album version that is just so oppressive and then turn it, just paging through tape and adding some session players, into this ecstatic, drunken New Orleans party. And then not only that, 5 years later, or whatever it was on Mixed Up, you can delete all that, throw in a baggy backbeat under it, and it still works. It's one of those things. It's like New Order's Blue Monday or any classic single. You can't ruin it. There's nothing you can do with Close to Me that won't let it shine through because of the bass line, because of the da-da-da-da-da-da, and the tinkly little keyboard xylophone lines. It's just so perfect and its own universe. And that's the definitive thing about The Cure that is now back on Head on the Door. What they do sounds like The Cure, meaning a band that when you say their name, you think of a sound, and they had lost that. So by here in 1985, Perry knows MTV is equally as important as FM radio. And in the case of The Cure, a band that frankly is trading on a lot of image, it's more important. Tim Pope now sees that the music video market is legitimate and that there's a career path there. So he decides to take it seriously. He's come out of the indie thing where he's had no budget and he's basically had to make videos out of stock footage, which is precisely what he did for Talk Talk on the It's My Life video. He meets up with Robert, they hit it off, and they come up with the In Between Days video. It is one of the most iconic pieces of film ever associated with a pop song. If you go back and did like a quick cut compilation of like the flavor of music video in the early and mid 80s, that's just starting to change in 1985 with really the success of hair metal in America, but also alternative acts like The Cure. One of the biggest beneficiaries of MTV out of anybody, it's the Human League. The Don't You Want Me video was enormous because MTV didn't have anything near that high concept to show that could legitimize the music video as a format. You know, there was this 3-year window leading up to when you get Boy George and Cyndi Lauper and the bands that MTV truly made. And one of the bands that MTV definitely made was Duran Duran. And that's where the entire history of The Cure's do-do-do-do-do thing comes from. From Robert's outrage that a band could succeed, the fact that the chorus of Hungry Like the Wolf is literally a bunch of guys going... Hey. is so inane that there's this part of Robert Smith that is completely offended. How can this be the biggest band in the world? Robert never lets go of that. And so this doo-doo-doo-doo joke thing becomes another linchpin aspect of the Cure sound. It's in all their singles. He's always hanging on it. It sort of ends up defining him in a way, even though it comes out of this place of mockery and derision. The two songs I really go up and down about, I really already covered Kyoto Song, but the other would be Sinking. That piano line is really perfect in its simplicity. It's almost got like a Freddie Mercury sincerity to it, a classic rock sincerity. It was like a forced effort to repeat the structure of their previous albums, to make another Faith. And the head on the door is not Faith. Trying to put this, you know, dolorous, long, slow anthem at the end, it doesn't really work anymore because the record's all over the place. So having Sinking, you know, just chop the album off after Screw, which is a little throwaway psychedelic drug song with probably one of the coolest moments of guitar tone in any Cure song. I am such a sucker for that overflanged ending lick. I've always loved Screw. Ultimately, when I look back on The Head on the Door, the song that I'm most stuck with and have been most stuck on was one that wasn't particularly a favorite of mine at the time as a kid, which is The Baby Screams. The claps were kind of electronic and synthetic and strange. It's just completely out of place. It's out of place on Head on the Door. And, you know, it's got that acid funk hangover from the top as well, but there's something about it. Smith's vocal performance on The Baby Screams, there is nothing like it. You have The Kiss, which is about to come out, and that's, you know, I've said before, that is the vocal performance of Robert Smith's career. But there's not a lot of rage apart from that song to be found. It's so uncommon in the band's catalog. It's really only in this 2-year period here around the top when you have like New Day and some other songs like Give Me It where he's like yelling in this way. There's this really fierce anger that it just kind of dissipates after Kiss Me. Here, it's very present tense. Each section of The Baby Scream sort of establishes itself in its own way as iconic. It's really weird. You've got the Couldn't Ask for More bridge running up to Strike Me Dead, and then you've got that wailing heaven repeating toward the end. It's really odd, and there's that driving, insistent lick, and you've got that great bass line and this, you know, weird little almost synthesizer 16th note thing throbbing underneath it. You know, if you're somebody who's living in playlist culture, The Baby Screams is exactly the kind of Cure treasure you're never gonna find, but it is really emblematic of what is so unique about The Cure at this time. Up to this point, what The Cure has done is probably most completely represented by The Baby Screams.
Cut us from all.
With the success of the singles, Chris Perry decides this is the moment to reintroduce America to this band. So that means a greatest hits record, which becomes Standing on a Beach. And so anytime this sort of thing happens, Robert's really concerned about, you know, how it dilutes the band and it's unfair to fans and I want to be authentic. And he's got all those punk rock hangups there. And so what he does is the same thing he did when the concert record came out. The live concert record from 1984 was very intentionally underproduced or tried to be as raw as possible. And so for that, Robert wanted it to not only be a budget price release, he wanted to put an entire second side on the cassette of weird anomalies, is what it's called, curiosity. And so Robert takes the same position here. They get all the singles together on a cassette called Standing on the Beach. You know, they may have been a little early in this. You could have waited until after Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me when they've hit the top 40 with Just Like Heaven and they are really now established multiple high production videos. But Standing on a Beach ultimately works. It works as a primer to Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. In addition to all the polishing up and the marketing and packaging of The Cure for the mainstream that happens in 1985-86, Chris Perry is still hung up on the fact that Boys Don't Cry was not a hit single. That is the song that convinced him he had picked the winner. He was sure it was going to break the top 10 in the UK and it died on its ass. And he never forgot it. And so he convinces Robert to, similar to Close to Me, because that worked, we're going to pull apart Boys Don't Cry. We're going to update it for a mid-80s kind of sound. We're going to use many of the original tracks and we're going to reissue it as the new voice, new mix version. And this carries this iconic image, one of the most iconic images in the history of rock, let alone The Cure, which is the infamous poster of Robert standing at a three-quarter with his back to you and his guitar slung over him for the Boys Don't Cry single. I had that Subway poster. I had the original one. It drives me nuts when I see all these bootlegs on eBay and shit. This Boys Don't Cry remix, which also carries a horrible 12-inch extended mix with, like, you know, hitting a sample button on Boys, and it's, oh God, it's so bad. It doesn't really go anywhere. They shoot the coolest video for this thing. They get like three teenage kids who physically sort of almost look like The Cure. And they actually also get Michael Dempsey back. The three actual members of the original Cure behind a sheet. And Tim Pope's figured out this way to, you know, reverse project or rear project their shadows while these kids are playing in front of them. And it starts out and it's like kind of in sync. And then it all goes sideways. And suddenly you realize like those aren't shadows. Those are the three adult members of The Cure. And Robert's, you know, dancing around, and then Tim Pope does the, you know, callback to the In Between Days video and has his eyes turn orange. It's a wonderful video. That's really the only lasting benefit to all the money and effort that was thrown at trying yet again to make Boys Don't Cry a hit and failing. Boys don't. This whole period, even though the Head on the Door itself is pretty well all over the place, it's all about Robert starting to take things seriously. The band are promoting themselves as a unit. You have to go back and look at the Head on the Door, especially the Standing on a Beach greatest hits and the Boys Don't Cry single. This whole period is about remarketing The Cure. Like, yeah, this guy's hair's crazy. He wears some makeup, etc. But he's really sharp. He gives great interviews. And this is a band you can work with and that's going to give you hit singles. So you're not throwing away airtime to back them and build them up. We're going to be there on the other side of this. The Cure become a viable commercial commodity.